Hello and welcome to Fundamentally Functional, Pearson's podcast on all things functional skills. My name is Chris Briggs and I am the Sector Manager for Post-16 English and Maths here at Pearson. And this evening I'm here with Johnny, who's the Head of English and Maths at Tyne Coast College. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. So, tell me a little bit about your role in the college.
Yes, I'm Head of English and Maths across Tyne Coast College, which has responsibility for sixth form and two FE colleges. We have some private provision as well, that the resit for functional skills and for GCSE falls under my remit. So, previously worked at Hartlepool College of Further Education, so I think I've got a good background there, a lot of training there. So, yeah, been in the role 4 months, really enjoying it.
Okay, excellent. And we're going to talk about English today. We did maths last month, so this month we're going to talk about English and what we can actually do to develop English skills in our learners. And we'll probably cover the range of qualifications, GCSE a little bit, and functional skills as well. So what do you see, Johnny, as being the most important thing for learners to be able to develop to do well with English?
Probably for me, the most important thing, and it's you possibly hate this because it's potentially outside of the classroom, it's enjoyment. Just enjoying English, enjoying reading. But it's the challenge, isn't it? How do we get them to enjoy it and to want to do it?
It is something that I always found difficult as a teacher. I've always said that nobody really signed up to do lessons with me as an English teacher. They came in to study a vocational qualification and then ended up in a classroom with me. And yeah, you can see that for me, a learner that's going to do well, you can see that they read extensively outside of the classroom. And it does seem to be a sort of skill that's dying down. I read a book called Freakonomics a few years back, and it was talking about literacy sort of skills, and the key sort of aspect of how to sort of see if somebody's going to be good and literate was to look at the number of books in their house. They don't have to read the books per se, but having access to books means they're more likely to pick them up and they're more likely to value reading as a skill. I do think that is important, and I think as well when you look at the functional skills especially, they are expected to be able to read at least three texts now at level one, level two, in a very short amount of time. So the reading is important. And again, you can't make them read.
No. And I think there are so many strategies that are employed in usually in primary and then at the secondary. Do we make it competitive? Do we give rewards? But then again, it becomes part of that cycle of assessment. It becomes part of that cycle of formality. And I've seen studies recently that have shown, I think it was a university in London, which essentially said that they spoke to people in their 20s, 30s, 40s and put some data together and said, when was the last time that you read a book for pleasure? And it tended to be years and years and years after they had left school because they were scarred by the experience, if you like, of only reading for assessment, not for pleasure, not for joy. You're reading because you have to, or you're reading because you need to be ready for this test.
Yeah, I agree. I've got two young ones myself, and the 10-year-old, he still reads for pleasure. But the 13-year-old now, he's starting to be in the throes of GCSE, and you can see his idea of reading for pleasure is just like, oh, I've got to read Macbeth. Why am I going to read for pleasure outside of that? It's painful enough as it is. I also feel that when you sort of bringing it back into the classroom, one of the issues that we have is we often ask the learners to read things, but we give them no real reason to read them. I talk about the pushback of the paper. So you give a learner a piece of paper and say, read this, please. And the first thing they do is push it back to you because there's no real reason. So some of the things we've been looking at, Pearson, is so how we can give the learners in the classroom a reason to read things. So something such as a short activity at the beginning, just to sort of introduce the text they're going to read to, even if it's just a pros and cons of a subject, and then they read the text for 1 minute just to quickly sort of see if it is, you know, their ideas were there. you know, I talk about reading the paper and how when you read the paper, you flick and you flick, because you don't read it until you find something you want to read. And in the classroom, really, they probably don't want to read.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's providing that context, and it's promoting it within a spectrum of narrative and of storytelling and of other types of media. So I think you're absolutely right. You get students in, particularly from my experience in school, they might have just had PE and they're bouncing off the walls, or they've come in from French and they might not have enjoyed it, or another subject that they like maybe more than English. And how are they going to become invested in what you've got in front of them? Because they just see it as just another part of the day sometimes that they've just got to get through.
Yeah.
So I think providing that palette, and providing that narrative where you can say, right, we're going to watch 5 and 10 minutes of a film clip or a TV show, or we're going to listen to a radio excerpt or a song, and then I'm going to link that to the text that we're reading, and I'm also going to link that to why it's important to you. Now, not necessarily, I know we talk a lot in FE about contextualization, which for me at times is slightly controversial, because we can't just produce 400 functional skills exams every month, one for the level 2 hairdressers, one for the level 3 bricklayers. We can't do that. I think we've got to make these skills, or we've got to make the papers and the materials and the text that we give students as linked as possible to something that all of them will experience in their lives, and maybe current affairs or things like, I say, like narrative and like other media.
It's quite interesting. I've just been working with your team earlier in the day, and I showed them something that I did back when I was teaching, an old lesson that's on Prezi, and it's about audience and purpose, and it uses adverts. So that the learners are watching YouTube clips of adverts to decide on who the audience for that advert is. And I sort of came up with that idea because it was very dry otherwise. Here's an advert. Who's this targeted at? Oh, it's an advert about dog shampoo. So it's for people who have dogs. Whereas using the sort of videos, you can bring comedy in and things like that. And it's just a little bit more interesting. And it isn't just then reading. They're using the skill that they need to from reading, but they're using it in a different, more interesting way, which they then go on to apply afterwards as well.
Yeah. And I think having that holistic connection with the text, with the media, with the background of it. I mean, when I taught in secondary, we were absolutely swamped with acronyms, and you talk about something, it can be dry. Sometimes it was, what's the purpose of this text? Who's the audience? What's the format? What's the topic? And you find you're having these conversations with 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds. What's the PAFT? What's the P? And you look at yourself in the mirror and sort of, what have I become?
You know,
I can get an advert on, I can get a film, and let's just actually make this accessible and engaging for everybody instead of just slavishly sticking to what they need and what we have to get them, you know?
I remember I did The Raven, Edgar Allan Poe, primarily using the episode of The Simpsons where they did that as well. And it was just an engaging way into the poem before the learners actually started to read it. So they understood what was happening. They understood a little bit more before they actually went in there. So aside from the actual engagement, what about the particular skills of reading? Is there any particular skills you feel that the learners need to develop?
I would say the things that we've talked about already, the things potentially that are not naturally occurring. So we've talked about skimming and scanning, and we've talked about sort of teaching them that vocabulary. You don't necessarily need to, because they can usually just do it. Things such as comparison, which provides a massive, massive stumbling block at GCSE, and evaluation. The two questions that students tend to just fully leave out on the GCSE, on paper one and paper two, the question four, the evaluation and that comparison, and just providing naturally occurring examples of that within lessons, but also working with vocational lecturers and doing it there. Certainly in previous roles, I've sat down with heads of engineering, deputy heads of engineering, and sort of said, bring us the texts that you will be using in lessons so that the students can see that it is a valuable skill, that we'll regularly need to do it. And first off, getting that investment, And then again, creating the naturally occurring scenarios so that they can practice those skills.
Yeah. It's interesting looking at the sort of feedback we've been providing to centres about the functional skills as well. And comparison between texts seems to be an area of weakness for learners. And as you say, it's not naturally occurring. You know, your average person on the street doesn't read a newspaper article in the metro and then go, I wonder what the Guardian says about that topic. it doesn't happen. And yet we're expecting them to be able to do that in the exam. And again, talking earlier with your team, we were discussing, you know, short texts on similar topics and just spending time looking at the similarities. What are the people in these texts saying that's the same? What are they saying that's completely at odds? Because it isn't a natural thing. I think it's something that I can do because of the fact that my background is in history, where we're expected to be able to do that. But on your everyday sort of thing, people just read things and then accept it's the truth and accept that that's right. And obviously what we're doing now is putting them in an exam conditions and saying, compare these two. And because it's a new standard at level one, these learners are now coming into level one with no real background in it and really struggling as well. I think aside from that, probably what you're looking at in terms of the functional skills reading paper and where the issues lie seem to be more alongside where we're testing not naturally reading sort of things. So learners are struggling with identifying language points and locational devices, things that we kind of take for granted. But again, probably, because I see these almost as being something that's part of the writing ability, but not assessed in the writing. Because really, it's very difficult because you can write something without actually having to use alliteration or hyperbole or something like that. But the learners need to be sort of exposed to things like that and why it's actually happening. And the questions have changed now for Pearson at level one, level two. And before, you used to have quite an open question. So what language features have has the writer used in this text? And the learners can write down three things and they can almost guess. They can write down the last three things that the tutor told them in the classroom and probably get a mark. Whereas when you look at it now at level one, it's multiple choice. So they need to know what these words mean, but they also need to know what they look like in the text. And at level two, they need to say what it is, but then give the example from the text. So they can't just say, okay, that the writer's used alliteration there. They have to give the example of it. And it becomes a little bit more difficult for them to do that. And again, it seems to be that is an area of struggle for the learners.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's the slow drip down in difficulty from on high. So in the Key Stage 4 curriculum, there are elements of probably what I did when I was at AS and A level. Key Stage 4 dripping down into Key Stage 3, Key Stage 3 dripping down into Key Stage 2. And I think there needs to be a more joined up approach instead of just a silo of a primary curriculum and then a secondary and then FE. We just sort of do the best we can and pick the pieces up. I think we need to be more collaborative and we need to be given funded opportunities from the DfE and from local authorities and academies and multi-academy trusts to have those share and good practice events and conversations. Primary school teachers are teaching reading and they're teaching writing skills.
Yeah.
That's what secondary school teachers are doing and that's what English teachers are doing in FE. So why do we not have the facility to get together and to talk about it and to share? Because as you say, it's for me generally the biggest thing when I was a secondary school teacher, and certainly when I've taught an FE, the biggest piece of feedback, the most frequent piece of feedback that I'm writing is either what feature or why do you think that?
Yeah.
And because they don't necessarily have, and I think part of that comes from the spoken language element being pulled as being given marks. I think that doesn't have as much prominence now, and students are struggling more greatly with giving full ideas and completely telling you and describing how they feel. And part of that again is probably you talk about the Sun or the Guardian or the Metro. I think part of that is only having one source of information.
Yeah.
Is the spread of social media. And I think that as we sort of have this fake news explosion, if you like, even around the coronavirus on the news this morning, It needs to be more part of a curriculum, that we should be looking for alternative pieces of evidence. We should be looking for comparison, and we should be double checking and making sure that what we think is correct.
Yeah. So more of the critical reading skills, the ability to read something and say, well, I disagree with that. Oh, I don't think this right. I read this other thing and it says it here. And it just, again, the problem, I think, is time as well. There isn't necessarily the time available to go into this sort of detail. You know, with functional skills is 55 GLH. What's the GLH for English GCSE these days?
Anywhere between 96 and 102.
102. It's not a lot of time to get through quite a high level qualification. And, you know, in schools, they get considerably more time. And yet, post 16, we're expected to be able to do the same thing with less time and less resources. So I think it's about trying to target what can be done quickly to improve the learner's sort of skills.
Yeah, absolutely. The concern, though, becomes, do we then just play this game of we're an exam factory? And that is where some of the establishments around the country are failing young people, and this is potentially why we have the lowest rate of literacy in the developed world for 19 to 24 year olds, because we don't always join up the dots and do it as efficiently and as effectively as we can. So I think it's about looking at what the main areas are for young people and putting things in place as quickly as possible, not in FE, not in school, in nursery, and even before then, and sort of returning funding to those sectors that really can make a difference with not too much more work.
Yeah, no, I agree. And for me, it's all about I think the idea is you're teaching people a skill. It's not just a skill to pass an exam. It's a skill for everyday life, and it will just make people generally more informed and more able to make decisions about themselves and about their lives. And you talk about the fake news, and it's entirely that. By improving their literacy skills, we have a more educated workforce that's able to do higher skilled jobs. And I think that's a positive for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of the research, obviously correlation and causation, we could talk about all day.
Yeah.
There's been studies done across the country, and specifically in Middlesbrough, there was that correlation between life expectancy and between literacy skills. And you sort of, it's a stark contrast to make, because you realise that actually, if you're not as well informed, if you're not as able to inform yourself, you're not as independent, and you're then currently, you're relying on a system that might not always be able to support you, and it does have those profound effects. So reading for me is communication. Being able to read and write is English, is communication. And I think maths is about being able to really prove what you're saying.
Yeah.
And if you're lacking those skills, there is an element of your life that will be missing, and you will have independence and opportunities essentially taken from you as a result. So getting that funding, getting that support in, as early as possible, and maintaining that. When we've both seen the cuts in adult education and the courses that are available.
Yeah.
And it really is a crying shame.
Yeah. Okay, moving on to the writing. What do you see as the issues within you, the learners that you're working with, and their writing skills?
Generally, it is it's the foundations, it's the building blocks. These students, they can come in and they can write you whatever text you need them to write. They can write often creatively, and they've often got some really great ideas. But the two main stumbling blocks, I would say, are the spelling, punctuation, and grammar, that they've been taught regularly from the age of 3, 4, and 5.
Yeah.
And I'd also say sometimes that creative flair and the originality of idea. And I think that is to do with as much as we have Netflix, we have Amazon Prime, we have these thousands and thousands of YouTube videos, and all of these different types of media that they can access, they generally tend to come back to the same story, which is usually some form of romance or some form of action film.
Yeah.
And that's what it turns into for creative writing.
I remember teaching creative writing in the GCSEs back in the day. And I always consider it to be the most painful thing that I've ever had to mark. They were very good at sort of setting it up, and then halfway down the page you think, this is going to go nowhere.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult. And towards the end, when teaching functional skills, I tried to move away from the learners doing written pieces for me because of this creativity sort of issue. And what we looked at was more extensive planning. So we would look at exam questions, and I would ask them to produce a half page plan of what they were going to write, because I knew they could write. And I used to take their work that they'd done in the vocational area and sit down with them and mark and correct and look at how I could improve from that. So they didn't need to do writing with me per se, but it was about the creativity of their sort of ideas. And looking at the feedback we've got from the examiners about the functional skills writing, one of the areas of concern is their ability to address all the points that they're addressing in the sort of the questions. And a minimally competent learner will just look at those bullet points and write a sentence or two sentences about them, where a good learner will actually expand upon that.
Yeah.
And you need that element of creativity. So the learners would get 20 minutes, which is far more than they get in the exam, to actually just look at the question and expand on it, and then explain to the person next to them, okay, this is what I'm going to write about, and this is why, and I'm going to write about, okay, this is this point here, and I'm going to expand by saying this, this, and this. And they then start to create the paragraphs that they want to do, and it becomes a more cohesive and fluid piece of work. And then, yeah, you know, there are times when I would then ask them to turn that into a piece of writing for me. Not every time, but times I would. And the pieces of writing they would then produce was far better than they were producing in the coursework that they were doing in the vocational area, because they'd actually sat, they thought about it, and they'd planned it out. And I think that's quite key as well.
Yeah, and I think it's a great approach, and you're absolutely spot on. And I think the thing that we never really talk about in terms of reading and writing skills, there is obviously some dialogue around planning, but it's given 5-10% of teacher time. And just having time to think. The students are going into 25 lessons a week in secondary. They've got the compulsory extra sessions, you know, they've got revision, they've got new apps that sort of help them along with everything. They don't get time to just stop and think about it. And I don't necessarily think our job is always to give them this formulaic way of writing. That often it's just to provide them with the skills and to show them what parameters they can operate within, and just sort of say, these are the rules for that text type. Do pretty much whatever you want within those rules. Not like you say, bullet point one says describe the dog. So that's paragraph one. Paragraph two says talk about what he's doing, and then a second paragraph on that only. Why can't the dog do this, do that, do the other? Because they're aware of the parameters and they know what skills they've got to get in there.
And I think outside of the planning, I think we get down to then, as you said before, the key component, the spelling, punctuation and grammar. With the functional skills, that's now increased in its weighting. And we've also got their ability to use a dictionary being removed from them. And that, again, is causing issues. I think the way Pearson assesses is quite holistic. It's very like the GCSE. But what we're noticing is it's not particularly the spelling and the punctuation that's causing the issue for the learners. The learners can make mistakes with punctuation, with spelling, and the overall feel and consistency of the text is okay. Where the issue lies is when you start to look at the grammatical structures of what they're using, especially now the Department for Education has introduced narratives into the level one, level two. And so you get learners who are writing things like, I went shopping tomorrow, where realistically, there's no way of understanding what they actually mean. Mm-hmm. You'd have to sit down and say, so do you mean in the future or in the past? And that then affects the whole feel. So, and it's very difficult because I don't think necessarily Post 16 is set up for the teaching of English grammar.
No, not at all. And I think the problem that we will have with it, as we've talked about before, and potentially with phonics as well, is that these students are just old enough so that they feel like young adults and they want the independence and the freedom, and the ego starts to develop, and just young enough that they can remember doing it in year one and year two and year three. So the two collide, and all of a sudden, I did this when I was six. I'm not doing this again. And then it becomes a completely different and more challenging environment. So I think it's all very well, you know, we have these reforms, and we have the reforms in the GCSE, and we say, you know, for a more educated populace, we need to make these qualifications more challenging at certain points. That's fantastic. But provide the time and provide the money and provide the support to make sure that those who potentially would have been lagging behind on the old qualification will have opportunity to catch up to that old qualification before then catching up on the new qualification. So I think that's what we're crying out for, and that's what we're screaming out for. Other than, as you say, the bespoke teaching styles, where we actually get to the heart of what the problem is and make it engaging and make it relevant.
Yeah, I think, you know, I do look back and I think to myself, you know, there are lessons that I taught where I thought, wow, that was an amazing lesson. And then there are lessons that I taught and I thought, how did I survive that? How did you know, we all make mistakes, but that general feel of one size fits all has always been sort of my issue, how I can teach a lesson with the same materials between two classes. And I learned that very quickly that just doesn't work. And what could be a sort of the most amazing lesson I've ever taught, 20 minutes later could be crashing and burning, and right, I'm going to have to do something else because this isn't going to work. And I think, you know, from a teaching point of view, it's key to understand what the learners want, but also what they're interested in as well. You know, you need to be focusing on things that they can engage with and they can relate to. Because going back to all of this, the fundamental key thing is that for the vast majority of them, they didn't sign up to do English. And so relating it to the vocational program wherever you can, having that conversation with the vocational team so that they are promoting the English skills as well, I think is key.
Yeah, I've spoken recently, actually, just about accountabilities, and I think you're spot on when you talk about the vocational teams. And I think if the vocational teams know their accountability, not just know it, but you support them in reaching it. So it's not just a case of these are the things that I need you to do for me. Good luck with it. I'll talk to you in a month. It's about sort of, this is what I want. This is how I think we can get there. Let's sit down and talk about what will and won't work. Yeah. And I think, not you say yourself, you know, the students, we need to know what they're interested in. I think we've got to do the same for other professionals. I think we've got to sit down with the welders and the hairdressers and the engineers and sort of say, what do you think would be most effective? What are your skills? What is your skill set? Yeah. How can we use your skill set instead of, like you say, the one size fits all, where I turn up as head of English and maths with a one-page document saying, let's improve attendance, sort it out, I'll see you in 6 months.
Yeah.
We need to sit down and say, sort of, how do you do monitoring and tracking in your area, and how can we sort of steal some of those ideas and integrate some of the things we've done? So I think, as well as finding out what students are interested in, for me as an idealistic English teacher, finding out what they could be interested in, and hopefully sort of culturally opening them up in new avenues that they maybe didn't know were there.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your time this evening. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Okay. Thank you,
sir.